This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hi, so this month we've had several questions sent in. The first one's from Richard Gerald, and he says, I live near Jodrell Bank and see it most days. I often wonder whether your radio telescopes operate day and night, and also what difference does the weather make to radio observations? Well, if you keep an eye on the big Lovell telescope, at least the Richard, you'll see that we do operate day and night. It turns out that you can do radio astronomy during the day just as much as you can during the night. The reason why you can't do normal sort of optical astronomy, if you like, during the day is because the sky's too bright. So basically visible light from the sun scatters off the Earth's atmosphere, and the blue wavelengths scatter more than the red wavelengths, so the sky appears blue, and that basically swamps the faint sort of visible light coming from the stars. But the radio waves that are coming from the sun don't scatter by anything like what the visible light scatters by. So in fact, the radio sky is effectively dark during the day, just like it is at night. So you can actually do radio astronomy 24 hours a day in principle, and you'll see the telescope moving around doing that. Certainly when there's no painting work going on in the summer, which is just about finished now this summer. We do have to worry about weather conditions, though. The biggest problem is high wind, and that's because you've got these very large structures. The Lovell telescope at Jodrell is 76 metres in diameter, the dish, the collecting area. And so you've basically got a huge sail. And if the wind sort of blows into that sail, if you've got the dish tipped over, sort of looking towards the horizon somewhere, and the wind gusts into that huge metal dish, then it could exert a strong enough force to actually blow the whole thing down, which would be a complete nightmare. Certainly the controller who's on duty doesn't want to be the one responsible for looking after the telescope when it blew down. So they keep a very close eye on the wind speed. And basically speeds of sort of 20 to 40 miles an hour, when you're getting into that region, we have to start taking steps to mitigate the effects of the wind. And that basically means observing at higher elevations, so at angles, greater angles above the horizon. And eventually, when the wind gets sufficiently strong, you have to park the telescope, point it straight upwards, and that presents the least resistance to the wind. And you actually turn it around so that the two towers that hold the ball up are in line with the wind direction. There have been incidents in the past where it came close to blowing down. There was an incident in 1976 when an unexpected gust of wind came in from the side, and it sort of actually made the two towers tilt over, which actually sort of skewed the whole telescope. And it meant that where the telescope was held up, the weight of the telescope was held up by a central wheel girder, it's called, that slid along and came within a centimetre or so of actually slipping off the support underneath. And if that had happened, the whole thing would have come down. And some bright spark in the control room realised that the thing to do was to turn the telescope round through 180 degrees, and the next gust of wind straightened it up again. Amazing enough, but true. And then afterwards, some diagonal struts were put in to brace the whole thing against that sort of skewing. The last thing to say about the weather really is that something like rain, for example, wet weather, can be a problem at the higher frequencies. So it's less of a problem at the lower frequencies, the longer wavelengths we use. So say frequencies we're talking about, maybe a few gigahertz, so that's a few billion hertz, wavelengths around 20 centimeters or so. You don't see much of an effect there. But as you go to the higher frequencies, heading up towards the highest frequency we observe with at Jodrell is 22 gigahertz at the moment, so wavelengths of a few centimetres, then you do start to see an effect. And it's when you get into those areas, those sorts of shorter wavelengths, higher frequencies, then you need to try and get up above a lot of the water vapour, for example, get up on mountains, or even, you know, get up on a satellite. Okay, next question is from Jeff Mutton, and Jeff asks about Sirius. So Sirius is the brightest star in the sky after the sun. And he says, how old is Sirius? It's old enough to have a white dwarf companion, no planetary nebula or any trace of its previous life. He's read a recent article on the age of Procyon, a similar star to Sirius, but there was no hint about Sirius in that paper. And he's just wondering what we know about it. Well, I found a an interesting recent paper about Sirius and its age, which we could link to on the website. But first, to say that, first of all, Sirius, it's a obviously it's a star that we see most nights when it's clear, very obvious, very bright star during the winter months particularly. It's a binary star, so there's actually two components. We call them Sirius A and Sirius B. We know a lot of things about Sirius, of course. It's so bright that people have observed it now for many years, of course. The binary period is about 50 years, so it takes about 50 years for the stars to orbit one another. We know we've got a very good distance to Sirius from parallax using the Hipparcos satellite, so that's useful. We can also watch the orbit, just sort of watch the stars move in their orbit from astrometry, measuring positions of the orbit. And that means that we can obtain the masses of the stars very accurately. Sirius A is about two solar masses, twice the mass of the Sun. There's been a measurement of its size, its actual diameter, from using the Very Large Telescope Interferometer in Chile. And that's shown that its radius is 1.7 times that of the Sun. So it's, you know, twice as massive, about 1.7 times the radius. And its luminosity is about 25 times that of the Sun. So it's about 25 times brighter than the Sun. And of course, what you can do with all this information is you can plug that into models of the structure of the star, which would predict the luminosity and the radius and so on as the star evolves. And that allows you to place it on a time sequence. So you can place the measured values onto a sequence of predicted values from the model, and that allows you to derive an age for the star. So it turns out that the age is something like about 240 million years. Now, Sirius B is the white dwarf star. So a white dwarf is basically a star that's, it would have originally been more massive than Sirius A. Sirius A hasn't evolved to become a red giant yet. Sirius B will have evolved faster. It will have originally been more massive. It will have burnt its nuclear fuel more rapidly, expanded to become a red giant, and then what's called an asymptotic giant branch star. It would have lost its outer layers, which had drifted out into space, the central part of the star where all the nuclear reactions took place. When it runs out of fuel, that's just a dead star, but extremely hot, about the size of the Earth. We call it a white dwarf star. So the expanding outer layers that went out from the outer parts of the AGB, the asymptotic giant branch star, they expand out into space and they're lit up by the hot core of the star, the exposed core of the star, and they're lit up and become visible as a planetary nebula. So what we know about Sirius B is we can measure its temperature now quite accurately. It turns out that its effective temperature, roughly its surface temperature, is about 25,000 degrees compared to, say, it's about 5,800 degrees for the Sun. So it's quite hot. Remember, it was the core of a star. It's where all the nuclear reactions used to take place. So it starts off incredibly hot and then gradually cools down over many, many, many millions of years. I mean, some white dwarfs probably won't cool down for the age of the universe. We can measure its mass. We can measure its mass to be one solar mass, more or less exactly. Again, from measuring the binary motion, the same technique that allowed us to get the mass of the other star in the system, Sirius A. So from those two bits of information, from the mass and the temperature, it turns out you can work out how old the white dwarf star is by looking at models of how white dwarf stars cool. So you can get a cooling age, which turns out to be about 125 million years, something like that. So in fact, you've got a sort of binary star system, which you assume both stars formed at the same time. So that's about 240 million years old, which you get from the age of Sirius A. And then you know that the white dwarf star has been around for 125 million years or so. So what it's telling you is that the white dwarf, the star that became the white dwarf, the progenitor of the white dwarf, was a sort of living star, a star that had nuclear burning going on in it for about 120 million years, basically the difference between 240 and 120 or so. So about 120 million years, you had this nuclear burning life of this star, and then it ran out of fuel, it ejected its planetary nebula, and it was left behind a white dwarf. Now, in fact, because you know what the nuclear burning lifetime, the lifetime of the star that became the white dwarf of Sirius B was, it lasted for 120 million years. We can actually compare that to stellar models, and we can say that a star with an initial mass of 5 times the mass of the Sun would have a lifetime of 120 million years. So what we've got now is information that Sirius B was originally a 5 solar mass star, whereas Sirius A is a 2 solar mass star still. The 5 solar mass star lived fast and died young, ran out of fuel after about 120 million years. And in that process, in the latter stages of that process, when it becomes a giant star, it returns about 4 solar masses of material to the interstellar medium, leaving behind this 1 solar mass white dwarf. And that fits, all these numbers turn out to fit pretty well, cross-check these against all the various models. They're telling us that our stellar models for these processes are actually pretty good. So there we go, 4 solar masses of material return to the ISM, and of course it's that material that forms the raw material for the next generation of stars. Now, of course, as Jeff points out, there is no visible planetary nebula there, but then, that planetary nebula was ejected about 120 million years ago, and the planetary nebula we see, the beautiful images we see with the Hubble Space Telescope, they're typically only a few thousand years old, really. So, as the central star dims, the planetary nebula drifts off into space, mixes up with the rest of the interstellar medium, the whole thing basically just fades away. So the planetary nebula phase is not a very long-lived phase, so it's no surprise we don't see anything 120 million years later. Okay, next question is from Paul Gibson. Paul asks about material falling into a black hole, and he says, as far as I can understand, matter that falls into a black hole takes an infinite amount of time to do so, according to a faraway observer. Does that mean that all active galactic nuclei will always appear as accretion disks to outsiders? Okay, so I guess what, first of all, to say Paul's absolutely right. The way that the gravitational effect of the black hole affects the way we see something as it falls towards the black hole is that as an object gets closer and closer and closer towards the so-called event horizon, the point beyond which nothing can escape, not even light, because the gravitational pull of the black hole is so strong. And if you imagine something falling towards that event horizon, perhaps carrying a clock with it, from the point of view of us as a sort of external observer watching this, the clock would tick slower and slower and slower and slower as it got closer and closer and closer to the event horizon. So he's right, it would take an infinite amount of time for that matter, that clock that's falling in, to reach the event horizon from our perspective. Of course, from the perspective of the material falling in, then it just passes through the event horizon without particularly noticing it. So yeah, an infalling body would appear to be frozen at the event horizon. Now, what he then mentions, he says, does that mean that all active galactic nuclei will always appear as accretion disks to outsiders? Well, an active galactic nucleus is this sort of supermassive black hole at the core of a galaxy, and the supermassive black hole's being fed material. Material's falling in towards it, and as it falls in, it orbits around the black hole, and so we get this thing called an accretion disk, a disk of matter that's swirling around, accreting, being falling onto the black hole and into the event horizon, sort of feeding the black hole at the core. And this stuff gets very hot, and a lot of the gravitational potential energy that's available from falling in from large distances into the black hole can be liberated as light across a wide range of the electromagnetic spectrum. We see these things shine as the very bright quasars, for example. So the question is, will they always appear to have accretion disks, since that everything gets frozen as it reaches the event horizon? Now, one of the things that's a sort of a but here that you've got to remember, yes, it's true that stuff would appear frozen at the event horizon, but what we've got to think about is the light that's being produced by the body that's falling in. What happens as that body approaches the event horizon is that the light that it's producing is increasingly redshifted, gravitationally redshifted. So it's made redder and dimmer as it basically tries to work, it's getting out of this huge deep gravitational well of the black hole, and so it's not got to the event horizon yet, so it can escape, but as it escapes, it's stretched out to redder and redder, longer and longer wavelengths, and indeed the photons, as they come out, they arrive at an observer separated by longer and longer time intervals, so the rate of arrival of photons reduces as well. So that means that as that material sort of crosses the event horizon, it's actually infinitely redshifted and unobservable. So in fact, that sort of counteracts this effect of being able to sort of just imagine seeing stuff frozen at the event horizon. Actually, it just sort of fades away as it approaches the event horizon. So stuff will still fall in. And of course, you know, the accretion disk, if you stop fueling the accretion disk, stop adding stuff to it, then it will all eventually just sort of disappear into the event horizon. So there isn't any sort of paradox or anything about that. You know, these things can just fade away. And therefore, you can have a supermassive black hole that just isn't bright because it doesn't have an accretion disk. It's either it's just stopped being fed for some reason. Maybe it was fed by the interaction of two galaxies crashing into each other, produces a sort of burst of activity as extra stuff falls into the black hole. But that process doesn't necessarily last forever. And this idea that stuff's infinitely frozen doesn't mean we should always see activity from these systems. The last question we have for this month is from Sean Mulcahy. I hope I've pronounced that right, Sean. And he says, hi, everyone. Since ancient times, when constellations were first imagined by our ancestors, have any of them changed shape so much that perhaps they wouldn't be recognized today if somehow somebody from the past was catapulted forwards 2,000 or so years? Okay, so the short answer to that is yes, constellations do change shape. And the reason for that is because the stars aren't fixed on the sky. Although if you look at the sky night after night, you see these sort of basically fixed patterns of stars. And obviously the ancients noticed that some of these star-like things moved differently. They wandered about on the sky. And so they named them planets from the Greek for wanderer. But they move because they're orbiting the sun. They're very much closer to us. However, the stars themselves do move. They're not fixed in space. They are, for example, the stars in the Milky Way are orbiting the center of the Milky Way. We orbit the Milky Way once every 220 million years or so. And as stars do that, they don't go in very nice, perfect circular orbits. They sort of oscillate up and down, and there's various perturbations. They're born in clusters that are each moving with their own relative velocities, and there's gravitational interactions and so on. So you've got to allow for the fact that stars can be moving, you know, in space, sort of, if you like, relative to the galaxy by maybe velocities of, say, between a few and 100 kilometers per second or so. Now, that's, you know, big velocities. The Earth's moving around its orbit at 30 kilometers per second. So it's high speeds, but of course the stars are very, very far away. So when you work out how fast they appear to be moving on the sky, and we'd measure that in terms of an angle, changing their position as a change in the angle. If you pointed at the star at one point and then the star moved and you changed the direction in which you were pointing, the angle through which you'd move your arm would be that change in angular position. We measure these motions of stars in units of arc seconds per year. So an arc second is actually 1/3600th of a degree. So it's a very small angle. The star with the largest motion, we call this motion proper motion, this sort of resulting from the actual movement of the star through space. The largest proper motion measured is for a star called Barnard's star, and it's about 10 arc seconds per year. So it's not very, you know, it would take 6 years for it to move by an arc minute. It would take 360 years for it to move by a degree. But that's the very fastest. And in fact, much more typically, stellar proper motions are something like a tenth of an arc second per year. Now, if you work out how long that would take to move for the star to change its position by 1 degree, it turns out to be about 36,000 years. So when you think about the size of the visible constellations, they are measured in degrees across, certainly, maybe some tens of degrees, depending on the constellation. And so it does take thousands of years for them to move, but it is measurable. So I guess in 2,000 years, which Sean mentioned, you'll get some slight change, but certainly over the course of 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 years, you will start to see significant changes in the shape of constellations like, you know, the Plough, for example, and other famous constellations. So it happens, but it doesn't happen very fast. Okay, that's about it for this month. So if you've got any more questions you'd like us to have a look at, then send them in to the Jodcast. You'll find a web form on the website for sending in your questions. And I'll speak to you again next month.